I don't want to use up time to talk yet again, because, you know, I already talked. But clearly, to me, this is a pregnant subject, as I like to say, and we don't know what the baby will look like. We're just trying to get a sense of some of those babies. Global Civil Society, which is in the title of this panel, right? Both a powerful category and a problematic category that I think needs to be sort of deciphered a bit. And I leave it to you, Dan. Will you sort of introduce yourself briefly?
That's good. Yes. I'm a professor of political economy and the associate director of the Robart Center for Canadian Studies at York University. And we have a large project on global cultural flows, new information technologies, and reimagining the nation. And we have also done extensive work, which some of you will be interested in, on the iconography of dissent. How iconography of political activists is reframing and the way we think about the world and opening new possibilities for activism. And this is available at our website, www.robarts.yorku.ca. But I want to, I might, if time is permitting, show you a bit at the end about new geographies, about the iconography of dissent and its impact as a part of a strategy of engagement and change. But my talk today is about wild zones of power. And I call these wild zones of power because it analyzes and looks at the role counterpublics, is a term that I'm going to introduce to you, which are informed and focused public bodies, global public bodies, that occupy the middle ground between social movements and global civil society. And these are actors as well as discursive publics. And they force us to rethink, I think, in a very clear way, some of the impacts and the problems of new information technology. The second thing I'm going to talk about is the end of trade determinism. We need to think more clearly and with greater precision about the large cycle of dissent, the long cycle of dissent, which has been in operation really since the 1980s, and to try to situate ourselves in it. And finally, I want to talk a bit about the new geographies of global activism and what are three scenarios for them, for the future. One scenario, as you're going to hear from me, is, of course, the optimistic scenario, one of more success. A second scenario is one of compromise and trade-off. And a third scenario is one of crash landing. So let's get on with it. Since the catalytic street demonstrations in Seattle burst onto the global stage, there is now an open-ended global cycle of dissent that has picked up speed and momentum, and it needs to be analyzed and understood, both for its potentiality and for its limitations. We need to look into our toolbox to grasp its puzzling dynamic. No one controls this exploding populist revolt, and no one knows when the long cycle of crowd activism will lose its energy, appeal, effectiveness, and enter into decline, disarray, and disappear off the world's stage. Society, whether today or in the past, has always had need of a system shock or a revolution, symbolic or real, when existing political and economic arrangements become increasingly dysfunctional. But a part of the present ideational crisis is that counterpublics and social movements and global civil society need a theory of collective action to counter what E.H. Carr termed the barrenness of realism. It needs a clear-cut course of action and requires a political theory to challenge the right's thinking about culture and politics. It requires, too, a pessimistic view of power that, if unchecked, corrupts the possessor. A progressive Democrat today has to be concerned about two things: the welfare of individuals and collective advancement. The bare-knuckle truth is that cynicism and alienation are always a root cause of every cycle of dissent. Cynicism is a powerful agent of disempowerment, but it is also a spur and motivator for public activism of all kinds, as we have seen since the late 90s. Under the right conditions, the process of constant doubting and tough questioning predictably predicts more skepticism, a greater willingness to challenge authority and to trigger large-scale activism. So the first thing is that when we look at where we are in the destructive cycle of activism, there is a link between what I call 25 years of growth-centered Keynesianism to 25 years of slow-growth monetarism. So in the 80s, in the Washington Consensus period, it looked like this: new rights for corporations as business restructures, unemployment rises everywhere, there's a chilling effect on wages and public policies, consumers get burned, personal debt increases, slow growth, right? At the core of the monetarist miracle, of course, is slow growth through zero inflation targets, zero deficit, low public debts, and of course high interest rates, which gives you a kind of a low growth model. Governments cut spending and taxes increase. So here we are, the classic TINA. There is no alternative to markets. But that was 20 years ago. But something dramatically happened which changed this destructive cycle of globalization. We have the network post-Seattle and contrarian counterpublics. Now, what is interesting, of course, in this view is that we have a sense of disempowerment, even while at the same time, paradoxically, we have these kinds of unprecedented forms of global activism. So why do we think that, what do we think really about this global cycle and its impact on public authority? First, of course, it is wrong to believe in the global north or in the global south that the state has gone the way of the plow horse of the 21st century. It is kind of interesting, after two decades of neoliberalism, that general government expenditure, it remains almost continuous where it was over the last 30 years. The social democratic Scandinavian countries remain strong in public spending. The countries, the social democratic countries of the EU remain largely where they were 30 years ago. Countries like Canada remain in the center, and the United States remains significantly a low spender and a low tax country. So what is important to us, of course, is to see where, for instance, in a post period of neoliberalism, what is the collective sense of society? And one indicator, I argue, is that taxes represent a collective sharing of resources in the public interest. And so what do you see happening? contrary to what we are told, that the less state, less tax model is the dominant model. In fact, it is not true. And it's certainly not true in the European Union, in the EU, where we see, for instance, between 1980 and 2000, and actually an increase of taxation, not a decrease. Japan is quite different in its system of taxation. And again, the United States, even in the United States, we see a gradual upward pressure. Now, we are very far from the complete privatization of public goods and services. And they remain, what I would argue, the very basis of modern sovereignty in the hands of the nation state. Now, this is a significant idea for us, because when we think of global civil society, social movements, and these discursive, highly informed counterpublics, the product of new information technology, the internet, the cell phone, the satellite, but significantly also radio and television, as I'll explain shortly, old technologies. Governments continue to be the frontline purchasers of goods and services, and their procurement policies represent an imposing presence in world markets. So I guess the important point here is that we are not living with a hollowed out state. And it is the strategic importance to civil society, global civil society, to these different counterpublics, to recapture and to strengthen public authority against global markets and, of course, global capital. Now, I just wanted to show you quickly, because I know this is not your primary focus, but even if we look at taxes on personal income and we compare three countries, we can see, again, some dips and fluctuation, but taxes have drifted upward in some instances. In Sweden, they were cut. In Canada, they drifted down. In Germany, they've remained remarkably the same. Here, too, also, if you look at the social basis of society, right, we can see that the role of the employer and their social contribution, very significant in Sweden, very significant in Germany, almost no change across. If we look at in the OECD average, which is the green line, again, here, too, we see that the kind of social fabric of society, again, to repeat the point, the social fabric of society remains in place, even if our perceptions and our psychology is that we are disempowered and that markets have won. This is, of course, wrong. I think it is a mistake, and this is kind of interesting to look at taxes on income, profits, and people. Well, I think what we are seeing taking place is that there is a new kind of politics taking place. And I've tried to give it some precision. And I think the old kind of Marxist liberal continuum has been reshaped by new citizenship practices and by identity politics. So the focus today is not on what you produce, but who you are. And what, of course, is the great motivator today is that people want a politics of choice rather than a politics of fate. And it is a significant difference. A politics of choice is what? And you choose who you are to act politically on your beliefs. Your politics are no longer or less determined by issues of class or ethnicity or gender or sexual orientation. It's not something you're born into. You have to shape one's political voice and define one's political interests. So there are four kind of new features on our map of activism. The first are those who see defending the social bond as a kind of primary focus of activity. And there are two types. There are the nixers and the fixers. The nixers want to nix the system, tear it down and rebuild, and there are those who are the fixers, who are the reformists. If we look at a second group, these are what I call the paradigm shifters, dystopics, who have a broad vision. They want to, they want a different world, but they want a different planet. And in this particular group of people, we see deep environmentalists, and we see other socialists, anarchists, communitarians. And on our compass of dissent, right, we see two other groups that are significant. One is those who focus on trust and security, civil liberties, democratic activism, and defending human rights. And the final group is are those drawn into this political realm of the radical counterpublic or the activist counterpublic through voice and empowerment. People who have been excluded and have been brought into political life to acquire voice and to acquire effect. So, on the ordinals, if you look at this, you'll see reinforcing social inclusion, enhancing individual freedom, building political community, and protecting human security. So what is significant about this as a discursive community of activists is they have little hierarchy, they have no unity, they have no fixed address, they have no or few iconic leaders, and they have flat hierarchies in ways that business theorists could only dream of. Now, what is significant, of course, is that this paradigm speaks to contemporary society. So if you look at the Pew survey, what you see is that people are activists by their social values first. And they want a kind of activism in which the personal is political, to fight the system, to fight authority and power that is neither transparent, democratic, nor accountable. So what we see is a very large cycle of dissent, because it is open, it is fluid, it is pluralistic, and represents all these a cross section. And I think its inclusivity is, in fact, the key to understanding. Many of us would like to say, oh, it needs unity. It needs more structure. It needs a bigger program. But this is not modern dissent and modern political activism. It has no roadmap, no single templates. And it is the tension between the parts that has allowed it, the long cycle of dissent, to broaden and deepen rather than to shrink and decline. So I want to say a bit about what I call my counterpublic, because if we think both theoretically and practically, we know that counterpublics have always existed. But they've never been as sharply defined, because we have this idea from Lippmann or from Chomsky about the phantom public. The phantom public says this, that politics and great issues are too complicated for the ordinary individual. They're too busy simply surviving. And so in Lippmann's notion of the phantom public, the idea was the public never got engaged in big picture, big vision issues. The second person who also is problematic for us is Chomsky. Because while Chomsky's model of the propaganda model of frames and filters and elites was good in the 50s and the 60s, it is, of course, less reliable today. Because with an explosion of alternative media, there is no single filter or frame. No one has to rely on the mainstream press. No one has to rely on a single source, right? You can go online. And it's very interesting when we actually do a chronology of the growth of the internet. There are two defining moments. One is earlier, 1980, when CNN is founded. And for the first time, news becomes explicitly global and not produced for a national audience. But CNN would not be an important story if it wasn't for the fact that BBC World created a second network. And Taibe Sank in 1983 created a third. And Europeans created others. And in 94, you have Al Jazeera. Right? So it is not surprising that we have a transformation of information flows when news is beamed in multiple languages for multiple audiences, and people can shop and compare. Now, are people shopping and comparing? Now, I would argue that all information technology has a conservative part. But theoretically, we also know that if new technologies can, people who use them can have access to them, that they empower people. So you can have two things happening, both empowerment and elite control. And when you have that kind of a dynamic, right, you have these Habermasian moment in which information, debate, discussion, and mobilization becomes the norm and not the exception. So, and when we look empirically to say, well, is this happening right? I have to insist on this. We have done an interesting study, and it's good that you should do your own studies. We looked at the global information infrastructure between 1990 and 2003. I think that's when our study ended. In this study, we tracked internet usage, cell phone, satellite TV, radio. I think that was the five. And we did it by regions. We did it for Africa. We did it for Latin America. We did it for Asia. We did it for the rich global north, etc. Now, three things were striking about this study. First, there is a kind of deficit. The second thing is, in this age, it is shrinking, not widening. So if you look at the number of internet users, it has passed from 200 million in 94 to 1 billion in a decade. This actually last month, the 1 billion user, so this is a phenomena that I say cannot be easily discussed. And when you look at Africa, we saw a larger divide on the computers, but a smaller divide on the cell phone and the satellite. So there are about a billion email internet users, and about 2 billion cell phones in the world today. And the cell phone has become a kind of alternative source of information, that, right, which is very important for activists. There's a lot of examples where activists do things through this. So I would argue that these highly diverse counterpublics organized around have given rise to forward-looking geographies of activism in the global north and the global south, and they have established, their aim is, I think, these alternative agendas to overturn the established social contract with neoliberalism that was imposed during the 1980s. So, what was the old activism? It's gone. It is anti-capitalist ideology. New style global movements see themselves as having vision and values ahead of the mainstream, issue-oriented, highly educated, informed in spades about their cause. But it's very important to look at the Pew survey on internet usage, because it tells us three things. Internet is for not only for personal servicing, serving and keeping in touch, but people use it for information enhancement. They want to know what is happening, and it is this ability to think through problems for oneself that I would argue is a powerful is the power behind the information revolution in a very practical way. But it is not permanent, and I'm going to explain why shortly. So, who are our discursive counterpublics, right? So I'm building now on the compass of dissent. There are four that interest me these are not all there are. First of all, the liberal skeptics. These are by far the largest. They're constantly challenging public authority and the elites about their values, their priorities, ideas. By instinct, they are wary of conventional wisdom and official explanations. They want to look behind the world of appearances and beyond accepted nostrums, and for that reason, they aren't loyal subjects. This is a test of citizenship, of whether or not you are a loyal or disloyal subject. So this is the largest group. And if I ask you, are you a skeptic? How many people here would identify with being a skeptic?
Well, just about everybody.
Just about everyone, okay. But how about being a contrarian, one step up or one step to the side? These are by temperament, tough opponents of government. They are professional doubters. They don't trust official explanations, are chary of bureaucrats and media spin, and they know how to dig their heels in by championing unpopular views. They need to see things from perspective of the minority, the underdog, and the maligned. And the interesting thing about contrarians, democratic contrarians, is they don't tire easily, are always drilling down to find out what governments have not told them. So this is really where media activists are. If you say, where are they? They're that. Well, what about others? What about the rest? People who think that this is too middle of the road. Okay, let's say you're a radical dystopic. You're a self-proclaimed paradigm shifter. That's attractive when you have a lot of hormones and testosterone. You know, these are men and women of conscience, libertarians, anarchists, communitarians of every kind, no compromise, do-gooders, green activists, Marxists, who are the shock troops of the anti-globalization movement. So, and as I said, they are really the Nixers who want to tear down the system. So you need shock troops to have an effective cycle of dissent, because if you only had skeptics and contrarians, you would be somewhere between the kind of disaggregated public and the propaganda model. And then, of course, you have practical utopians who want to reform a system that has gone wrong. They want to fix the world, make multinational corporations answerable before the law, create accountable institutions of the world economy, and ratchet up the United Nations as the world's governing body. They are not revolutionaries, but hard-nosed reformers, advocating small, medium, and large-scale change from everything, starting with the environment, onto global justice, to human rights. So, we can say there are, if we say those are our four communities, should we try to benchmark global activism? And let us create four benchmarks. First, ideas that empower popular voice, constituency building. So I would say the first thing on this, that the ideas of modern counterpublics in all varieties, skeptics, contrarians, paradigm shifters, that they have become powerful because of their ideas. The truth be known, how many activists are there in the world today? 100,000? 150, 200,000, very small. So their effect can only be small. And furthermore, if you demonstrate three times a year, what do you do the rest of the time? You're out, right, with your ideas. It's your ideas that change mentalities and psychology. You're trying to persuade people to change their ideas. And who are you speaking to if you're interested in voice? To the political middle. You're not speaking to your family because they don't listen to you. Your real family, right? You may be speaking to your friends, but they're not a kind of, they're a good constituent because they're they are a reinforcement group. But the key group of ideas and outlook you want to change are those in the middle. You must win the hearts and minds if you want a different world and a different system of accountability and a vibrant democracy. So, what is the strategic capacity to mobilize people? Well, you have to have popular means. So we have them: internet, cell phones, global news broadcasting. Three which are popular, not controlled, whose consequences cannot be controlled. So what happens? I'm watching CNN, not my favorite. It's more interesting out of London. which is a peculiar thing with CNN, than what you see in the United States. You have to say, why is that? So I see things about the Iraq war in which American generals are saying, this is a terrific thing we're doing, we're in control. Now, when you see this same general, and a person in Ohio sees the same general, do you come away with the same message? Do you feel reassured, or is this delusion when you watch CNN? So there's always what Stuart Hall calls the kind of interactive interpretation of modern media. And I think this is important because it means that the cycle of dissent is a flow, it is unpredictable, it can go up and down, right? Remember, with anything that's unpredictable, can have good or bad consequences, consequences which you may be happy to see, consequences which you may not. And of course, it is it may have many long-term effects. So two other things that are important. Politics is different. Politics today is a lifestyle, a commitment, part of your identity. This is different. And why is this important? Because it means you can be political part-time rather than full-time. The old ideal was what I call very famous Canadian communist, Norman Bethune, who was a full-time revolutionary. Maybe some of you aspire to be a full-time revolutionary. I don't know. But the success of modern dissent is that you can enter and exit easily. Right? So this is very important. So the question is, are we in for a soft landing, a hard landing, or a crash landing of this dissent? Now I have to show you one other thing that's going to shock you. I wanted to look at whether neoliberalism is rising or declining in the polls. Are people voting with their interests, like rational choice theorists would like us to believe, or with their values? Now, if people vote with values, they screw things up. They become innovative. They step outside the box, right? It means that neoliberalism and these kinds of reforms are much more viewed with suspicion and skepticism. So what did I do? We said, okay, there is a disconnect between neoliberalism and voting. Right? So to investigate this question, we looked at national political parties in 11 countries, which were coded market or public according to party platforms, policies, and positions on key issues. So this was the kind of methodology here. What? Okay, I just finished this. And then. So anyway, you can see if you support the market, more privatization, economic liberalization, laissez-faire economic policy, rolling back the welfare state, support public provision of goods and services, robust continued market, interventionist policy. So what happened between since 1999 when we looked at these 11 countries? Well, you can see that the green part, the green is is the raw vote, right, before it gets translated into seats. What you see is that, in fact, people, when voting, right, for making a decision, vote for public or parties that want to enhance public authority rather than parties that want to enhance markets. So here are our findings. Public parties outperform market-oriented parties in 19 of 22 elections. You won't believe this. I know, because our mentalities are that we're losing. And the mentality is that neoliberalism is triumphant, when in fact we've made a shift from TINA, there is no alternative, to TAPA. There are plenty of alternatives. In Spain, Canada, Brazil, UK, Sweden, Argentina, India, New Zealand, voters rejected the neoliberal option. So how deep is the swing towards the public? Public enhancing parties gain ground in 5 of the 11 countries. Market parties achieve decisive gains in just 1, in the United States. In the popular vote, in Germany, UK, Sweden, public sphere parties' support did not decline. So this is a kind of an interesting thing, is that where you have multi-party systems, it serves as a break on a break, it limits polarization. The only way neoliberalism can really come to office is in a two-party model. It's more facilitated by this. And in the US, of course, the brokerage occurs within parties rather than in any other way. So, what does left and right mean today? It is defined by deepening market competitiveness or strengthening public authority. So, if I'm out of time, I'm out of time. I have these three scenarios. If you want, I don't want to poach on other people's.
Well, I wanted to have time for just also a couple of questions.
Okay. So I just want to say that if you say if you take the pessimistic scenario, oh my goodness, that's why I did. You can't see this. my God, this is my computer. This is on the role of the power of ideas. The left and popular movements today think in terms of icons as modern ideograms, and images these images are backed by ideas. So there is a way, the way activism creates new frames and new values through this. But this I can show you later. But I would say that, let me see if I can go back. Anyway, there are these three things. Question is whether a division in this array face these global activists, I have an answer for this, or whether this global dissent is too big to shut down and it is going to continue. Well, I apologize for going over my time limit. Did you have a question?
Great, thank you. Good to have at least a couple of questions after each speaker so that we begin to hear you as well. So does anybody have a question? I guess I should have told you, so next time be ready. Yes.
Hi, I'm just wondering, you gave a really interesting taxonomy of activists and people who might be going against the conventional wisdom. And I couldn't help but wonder, in a room full, say, of skeptics, what would it mean to be a contrarian? And that got me thinking, is there a similar shift in taxonomy, as a fragmentation maybe, of the people who manufacture and consume and buy into conventional wisdom, thanks to these new media? Is there a similar fragmenting or shift of some kind among the people who are representing the things that skeptics and contrarians might be going against?
Well, I think there are some other things that I didn't have time to talk about. First of all, a lot of the mainstream media now actually find that contrarian counterpublics make for good information and entertainment. So that there is a kind of a need for balance, right, for opening up mainstream ideas, mainstream media, with activists, dissenters, people with different ideas. And I would argue that that this is actually broadened. So in another paper I wrote on the political economy of dissent, for instance, you can look at programs in France called La Vie Publique, La Vie Privée, Charlie Rose. You have a lot of debate and discussion. So it has gone from the bottom up into the mainstream. The second thing is iconic. There are a lot of public intellectuals who write. Naomi Klein from Toronto, she writes in 10 newspapers all over the world. Chomsky is a kind of a public intellectual with a huge audience, contrary to the propaganda model, right? He has more access at many different levels to different audiences. And this is part of the what I call the process of change, quite dramatic change. Ian McEwan in his novel Saturday wrote, "The times are strange enough, why make things up?" So you need to get out of the box, the standard way of thinking, wealth, base, superstructure, single identity, multiple identity. There's a flow and there's a flow and unpredictability that people respond to the issues. So if you didn't have Bush, of course, and unilateralism, you would have a very different quite kind of frame. So move a cycle of dissent is always driven by immediate kind of line in the sand kinds of defining issues. And when we can track public opinion this way.